From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Kevin Ward Jr. lost his life last weekend on a sprint car track. Ahead on Only a Game, what NASCAR and various racetracks are doing to stop drivers from leaving their cars. Also, Alabama earns a number two ranking without naming a starting quarterback, and Olympic skiers train 50 feet below the ocean surface. We'll also look at whether the gay games will be necessary in the future, and John Shulian presents a collection of the best football writing. Also ahead, lawn bowls, an ancient sport for young bowlers and for the not-so-young.
I took it up as a hobby and found out I was quite good at it and then got selected in competition. And so the bowls don't know your age.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The beginning of the NFL regular season is 3 weeks away. To get ready for week one, nearly half the league's franchises are calling on another team for help. 13 teams are participating in joint practices this summer with varying degrees of success. ESPN senior NFL writer and commentator John Clayton joins me. John, welcome to Only a Game.
Hey, Bill. Good to be with you.
Joint practices are not new, but they do seem to have become more popular. Why is that?
What coaches are finding out with the new CBA, there's such a limit to what you're able to do in your own practices. You know, what you don't have the ability to do is maybe do the red zone, the situational stuff as much as you would like on a competitive basis. Bill Belichick spoke to this the best. You know, he's had two joint practices. He could get 20 red zone plays in against another team, where in a preseason he's going to be lucky to maybe get 5 or 6 red zone plays. And so it gives you a chance to, one, help evaluate your players better. Two, add more things for the starters that they can do. And then three, really give a better competitive edge and kind of get an energy that you might be missing if you're going to be together with this team for about maybe 2 weeks or 15 days.
Were there specific changes to the 2011 collective bargaining agreement that made these dual practices more likely?
I mean, dramatic, because what you have now is a limitation of the number of times that a coach can have his players with shoulder pads on. And it's really basically once a week. You also have limitations in the time you can be on the field. I mean, no more two-a-days. You know, meeting times are regimented, all those different things. And so all those things changed because the players were coming out of the CBA making less money. And so what they wanted to do is try to preserve their body a little bit better.
Last week, you were in Virginia for a practice featuring Bill Belichick's New England Patriots and Washington's NFL franchise. Was that interaction different from what might have happened between two other teams?
I think it took everything to the highest level, and I think speaks to where a lot of this stuff is going to go, because it was a practice that almost lasted 3 hours. There was no fights. Everything was done in a very organized way. But what you can look for in the future, and this could come as soon as next year, there is an effort, or at least a thought by Roger Goodell, to try to eliminate one or two preseason games. And if that's going to be the case, you know, you could take a Redskin Patriot model, because it's such a benefit, and it really helps a team like New England, a team like Philadelphia, jump ahead of the curve compared to all the teams that aren't doing it.
You mentioned that there were no fights between the New England players and the Washington players. At a joint practice on Tuesday, the Dallas Cowboys and the Oakland Raiders did get into a brawl. I wonder if that's one of the downsides of joint practices.
I was actually last week over in Atlanta and Tennessee, and there was not as many fights as there were in the Raider practice against the Cowboys, but there were fights. It's not as bad as some of the old days, you know, when you would have Jerry Glanville take a Atlanta Falcon team and maybe have a dual practice and have a lot of fights. But it is a concern, because they may be protected with helmets and different type of gear, but also the hands are not, and so you may have broken hands or some kind of an injury, and that's what you don't want when you have a dual practice and you have all that energy going around.
You make a good case that these dual practices benefit players and coaches, but surely fans would rather watch actual preseason games, no?
I question that. I mean, the season ticket holders that go to the regular season games, I don't think like paying regular season prices for preseason games, and I think they'd like to see a better quality of the games in the preseason, and maybe the best way to do that is to eliminate one or eliminate two and then see down the line if they can get 18 regular season games.
If this becomes popular enough, won't the NFL just charge fans whatever the league can get to watch these dual practices?
Well, yeah, but I think there's the limit to what you can charge on that because you're in very unusual places. There is some charge. I mean, you can maybe pay $6 or $8, in some cases $15. But I think the one thing is it's a good family-type environment for a lot of the people that may not be able to afford some of the $100, $150 tickets. You know, they can take their families to some of these events. I mean, you know, the success of that New England, Washington one was immense. They were down in Richmond, Virginia. They were drawing 22,000 to 23,000 people, and it was a nice family environment. It was a great situation for the fans to be able to enjoy things. So, you know, fans, if they had a choice, if they would rather probably pay $15 to watch a practice as opposed to $100 to watch a third or fourth preseason game.
John Clayton is a senior NFL writer and commentator for ESPN. John, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Bill, thank you.
Alabama opens its 2014 season on August 30th against West Virginia, but the Crimson Tide's starting quarterback remains to be determined. One thing is certain, whoever lands the job will be playing his first meaningful minutes in college football. That hasn't stopped the coaches' poll from making Alabama number two in the preseason rankings. Matt Hinton has written about the team's quarterback situation for Grantland, and he joins me now. Matt, welcome to Only a Game.
Glad to be on.
Is Alabama the only place where quarterback isn't the most important position?
If you look at the other teams that are projected as really serious contenders for the national championship, Alabama is the only one that doesn't return a starting quarterback. Alabama doesn't have a quarterback who has even taken a meaningful snap yet in college. I don't know that there's any other program right now that would get the benefit of the doubt. Usually when you lose a quarterback, that leads to what they call a rebuilding year.
In the past, Alabama has won national championships with novice quarterbacks. You suggest that head coach Nick Saban has been able to do so by, quote, making his quarterbacks as interchangeable as the supporting cast. How does that work?
Well, the short answer is by building great defenses. I mean, Alabama's defense is perennially under Saban the best in the SEC. The rest of the offense is extremely talented as well. But I did also want to challenge the notion a little bit of the interchangeable game manager quarterback. I mean, I think it's easy to look at the last decade of Alabama quarterbacks and say they all look alike. But I think that the last quarterback they had there, A.J. McCarron, I think was a little bit better than that. I mean, I think he may still fit into the broad game manager category, but I think if you look at his performance in really big games, A.J. McCarron had the best pass efficiency rating in the nation against ranked opponents last year.
So is Alabama appropriately ranked at number two in the nation?
Most of the time, Alabama is not going to give up more than 14 to 17 points. But as I said, they're not quite the monolith on defense that they used to be. And I think that's because offenses, I mean, we're really in an offensive moment right now. I think offenses have really evolved strategically ahead of defenses. And so even top defenses like Alabama have games where they're going to struggle. I mean, they had three games last year where they really did not play well. I think it's very difficult right now when your goal is a national championship where there's really almost no margin for error, where one loss can potentially ruin your entire season. It's very hard to say, you know, we can just rely on our defense every single week. You need a quarterback who can deliver for you and really put up some big numbers when he needs to, even if that's not your offense all the time. And I don't know if McCarron is going to be as easily replaced as the preseason polls suggest.
Matt Hinton writes about college football for multiple outlets, and you can link to his article, QB One and the Same, at our website, onlyagame.org. Thanks a lot, Matt.
Thanks for having me.
This week, Arizona State offensive lineman Edward Chip Serafin became the first active openly gay football player at a Division I school. Serafin's announcement happened to coincide with Gay Games 9 in Cleveland. The games were formed to promote acceptance of gay athletes. Now that that acceptance is growing, reporter Afi Scruggs asks what's next for the quadrennial competition.
Sid Ziegler has seen his share of gay games. Sydney in 2002, Chicago in 2006. He covers gay athletics on his site, Outsports.com. He says that few games have made a stronger statement than this week's Gay Games 9 in Cleveland.
Walking around here in Northeast Ohio, and seeing the rainbow flags everywhere, talking to the police and business owners and just strangers on the street, they are incredibly welcoming. And this is still a state that is, at the end of the day, discriminatory against us.
That's the impact Dr. Tom Waddell envisioned when he founded the Gay Games back in 1981. He wanted the Games to change minds about gay athletes in particular and gay people in general. But with more athletes coming out, will future Gay Games be about competition and less about making a statement? Raymond Moore thinks so. He traveled from Los Angeles for badminton, not politics.
We're not here to say, hey, we're out and proud, even though we are, but that's not why we're here. I'm here just because we want to play the game amongst different competitors across the country and just to meet people from other countries that are actually came here to play.
The games have helped open the closet for high-profile professional athletes. The NFL's Michael Sam came out in May. WNBA player Brittany Griner came out last year. So did the NBA's Jason Collins. And this week, Arizona State offensive lineman Chip Seraphim became the first active Division I college football player to come out. Again, Raymond Moore.
As a society, we've grown so much, and now we have so much more acceptance of gays and African Americans, and you know, I think just in general, because we're such a diverse culture now in the United States. I think being gay isn't, you don't have to be a statement anymore, because nobody's beating you down on the street.
In the United States, yes. But international athletes have to be vigilant. Aliessa came from Moscow to play badminton in Cleveland. She couldn't tell her family the real name of the game she's attending. That's why she asked only her first name.
To us, just the word gay is extremely unacceptable. People don't even have a neutral attitude when they hear that word.
52 countries were represented at the games. Because of hostilities at home, organizers guard against accidentally outing people, says Kurt Dahl. He's the co-president of the National Federation of Gay Games.
And we give them the option where they don't even want their name or their picture shown because they're afraid of what will happen when they go back home.
Sid Ziegler again.
While we look at Europe as incredibly inclusive, a lot of their sports are behind our sports. European soccer is desperately racist and homophobic.
Ziegler said Paris organizers wanted the 2018 games there because they could change attitudes.
They feel that there is a lot of work still to be done, even in places like Paris. So they believe that cultural impact and political impact in sports and politics that we can have there as a group can be very powerful.
Ironically, growing acceptance of gay athletes in the United States has made the games a victim of its own success. Organizers are having problems recruiting young people.
The youth don't know the history of what the gay games have gone through, what we've accomplished over the last 30-plus years, so they don't understand what the gay games are, and that's what we need to focus on.
Dahl said the Federation will spend the next 4 years helping local sports clubs recruit younger members. For Only a Game, I'm Afi Scruggs in Cleveland.
Coming up on Only a Game, we sample a collection of the best football writing of all time. But first, last Saturday night, 20-year-old sprint car driver Kevin Ward Jr. lost his life. We may never fully understand the exact circumstances of that tragedy, but we do know this. Ward's car crashed after being crowded by the car driven by NASCAR superstar Tony Stewart, who moonlights in sprint cars. Ward left his vehicle and approached Stewart's car. Seconds later, Stewart's car struck and killed him. Ryan McGee covers auto racing and other sports for ESPN the magazine. Ryan, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me.
Kevin Ward left his vehicle, obviously angry, while the rest of the field was under caution. He is far from the first driver to do that. Given the obvious risks, why do so many drivers leave their cars?
There is an adrenaline level that these drivers are operating at that we don't really understand because they're just not built like the rest of us. And in that situation, too, where it's a 20-year-old young up-and-coming racer who one day hopes to be Tony Stewart when he grows up, you know, it was an opportunity to let Tony Stewart know, I'm out here and I'm not going to let you bully me. I've seen this so many times over the years where drivers will get out of their car and just walk out into traffic. But to the eye, it's very deceiving because you've been watching cars go 190 miles an hour all afternoon. Under caution, it looks like they're crawling along. The truth is they're doing about 55 miles per hour. Mm-hmm. So for a driver to walk out onto the racetrack, he's literally walking out into the highway in your local city. when the emotion takes over and the adrenaline takes over and you want to make a point, common sense sometimes doesn't really come into play.
In the days following the accident, some news outlets branded Stewart as a hothead with a temper, and certainly there is historical evidence for that characterization. But auto racing insiders and fellow drivers have been quick to describe him as a man with a big heart who would never intentionally injure another driver. Is the idea of intent just too horrifying for those in motorsports to contemplate?
A little bit, and Tony's a very complicated person. I wouldn't call him a friend, but he's someone that I have been around, someone I have covered, someone I have interacted with professionally and personally for, you know, the better part of a decade and a half. And there are moments where Tony's rage takes over, and then there are days when you see this gentle person that people are talking about. 10, 15 years ago, he might cuss me out one day because I asked him a question after a race, and then a week later, he throws his arm around me and asks me about my family. But do I think there was any intent to hurt this kid? I don't believe that. And when he goes back to these short tracks, he's not doing it to bully young guys. He's not doing it to bully the weekend warriors who are bankrupting their families just to race on the weekends. He's doing it because he's telling these short track promoters, use my name to sell tickets. He owns short tracks himself. He's done more for short track sprint car racing than arguably anyone in the history of that sport. So was there intent? No. But it certainly was a terrible accident that one day we'll hopefully know all the truth about.
NASCAR and numbers of lower-level dirt tracks have instituted new rules to discourage drivers from leaving their disabled vehicles, except, of course, in the case of fire. Undoubtedly, drivers, sports writers, and spectators are more aware today than they were just over a week ago of the dangers of doing that. But how long will that awareness last?
Well, the fact that the rules have been tightened up, and that announcement took place on Friday morning, now they're going to be enforced, and now they're a little more defined. And so what will happen typically is short tracks will follow. Other sanctioning bodies will follow. You look back 13 years at the death of Dale Earnhardt, the sting of that has never gone away. And when you walk through the garage, particularly in the NASCAR Sprint Cup Series now, and you see the safety implements that are on these race cars that weren't there 10 years ago and some that weren't there 5 years ago, that all stems from losing Dale Earnhardt, the biggest star in the sport. Now, keeping drivers in the race car, ultimately, I think that will be the legacy of Kevin Ward Jr., just like it was for Dale Earnhardt Sr.
Ryan McGee is a senior writer for ESPN, the magazine. Ryan, thank you very much for joining me.
Anytime.
The U.S. men's soccer team made it to the round of 16 in this year's World Cup in Brazil, and there is a U.S. side that's gone much, much further with the help of electric motors. George Lavender reports.
Can I lift the... Can I... Is it very heavy?
It's about 10 pounds.
Sitting on Chris Finn's desk in his home in San Leandro, California, is a piece of sporting history. It's a trophy, about a foot tall, and looks kind of like a metal flame rising up and encircling the globe. This isn't a copy, this is the actual World Cup, and it's just sitting on your desk.
This is the actual World Cup sitting on my desk.
But this isn't the FIFA World Cup. This is the FIFA trophy. The P is for power chair.
In the rest of the world, they call it power chair football. The U.S. always has to be different. I think power soccer sounds more cool.
This is probably the only time I will ever get to lift a World Cup for power soccer or otherwise, but Finn has coached the U.S. national team to win two of them and the Copa America tournament. As a kid, he says he dreamed of being the next Pelé.
I've been a big sports person my whole life before my injury. And after my injury in 1992, when I was 21 years old, I couldn't find a sport that I could play as a C4-5 quadriplegic. I went on the wheelchair basketball court and they kicked me off because I don't have a manual chair that I could push.
Like the chairs the athletes use, this game is electric. On a basketball court in San Jose, California, two teams of four players are using motorized wheelchairs to spin, push, and hit a beach ball-sized soccer ball around a court and into the opposing team's goal.
Power soccer is the same as outdoor soccer. It's just played in a power wheelchair. Some players maybe only be able to move two fingers instead of running up and down the court. But as the yellow pages say, let your fingers do the walking. And that's all you really need to control that joystick to play the game.
At courtside, goalkeeper and coach Jessica Lehman is rallying her team, Kryptonite Pride, as they take on local rivals, the Bombers.
You guys are totally pushing the ball. You know, we're keeping up the pressure, right? We're making them work.
Lehman has used a wheelchair all her life, and before she came to power soccer, says she had never really been into sport. But back in 2005, she went along to a local team practice just to check it out.
And they said, oh, do you want to try it? And I said, no, I'm just here to watch. And I still felt like, I don't do sports, you know, I just want to see this. And so I watched for about half an hour, and, you know, my eyes got wider as I was watching. And then I said, okay, I'm ready to try it. And so they strapped a guard on my chair and never looked back. Sounds like the operating room.
I know.
Where are the tools? Yes, that's both.
At the game in San Jose, a pit crew of friends and attendants is working on the front of Nikki Brown Booker's chair.
It's a metal guard that I use to hit the ball with. Some people have plastic guards, but the metal guards are the best.
It looks pretty beaten up.
Yeah. I've taken some pretty hard hits with it, and I've hit some people a few times kind of hard, but mostly I've taken some hard hits. Because as you can see, when you're playing and you're going for the ball and you're getting really aggressive, sometimes you end up hitting other players.
Brown Booker says she grew up in a family that was really into sports. She says power soccer has been her chance to take part.
It's really nice to think that I could actually, as a person in a wheelchair with a disability, could also play sports and be really competitive. And as a matter of fact, the last game that we played, my brother was with us in the car as we drove down to San Jose, and he was like, wow, you guys really take this game seriously. I'm like, yeah, this is a real sport for us.
Less than a year after she started playing power soccer, a couple of Jessica Lehmann's teammates told her she should try out for the national team, being put together for the first Power Soccer World Cup in 2007 in Japan.
I felt like, how could I possibly try out? I just started playing. But, you know, they encouraged me to do it. They said, "What? There's no harm in trying out. You're a good player. You're going to get good training." And I realized, all right, that sounds like fun. If they think I have a shot, why wouldn't I go for it?
Lehmann was picked for the team, and a year later, she was on her way to Tokyo. At first, expectations of the U.S. team were low, but that changed.
We played these teams from all over the world and won them all, and then we came up against France in the final, and it came down to a penalty kick shootout. I remember holding my teammate's hand and squeezing so hard, I thought we were both going to lose all circulation.
We took a kick, made it. France took a kick, made it.
Chris Finn was the coach.
They took their second kick, and our goalie, J.C. Russo, blocks it.
I think because it was such an unusual experience in power soccer, nobody was quite sure what had happened. And so it was a moment before people started cheering and we realized that we had just won the World Cup.
Lehmann hasn't returned to the national team since 2007, but she's still passionate about the sport.
Power soccer has changed my life for the better. So I really would love to see it spread. And every chance I have, if I see people in power chairs, I talk to them about the sport. And it's always like, you know, just come to a practice, we'll put a guard on you and try it. Because I know that's enough. I know when people do that, they want to play.
Next year's Power Soccer World Cup will be hosted by Brazil. In 2015, the U.S. national team will have the chance to do something no other soccer team has ever done. Win 3 titles in a row. For Only a Game, I'm George Lavender.
Part of the attraction of football, great writing about the national sport, is the opportunity to see how the game itself has changed. The team representing Yale was once a national power. 60 years ago, the pro game was regarded as disreputable by those who regarded it at all. There are stories of those days in the collection, but there are also stories about today's magnificently prosperous NFL and the plagues afflicting retired players. John Shulian edited Football, great writing about the national sport for the Library of America. John, welcome back to Only a Game.
Great to be here, Bill. Thank you.
A lot of what's in the book first appeared in newspapers as late as the 40s and 50s. You write in the introduction that the press started out treating the game like a ne'er-do-well brother-in-law. Why was that?
I just think football didn't have the hold that it does today. One of the pieces in the book is from an oral history that a wonderful guy named Myron Cope put together. John McNally is the player's name, and one day he forgot that his team was playing on Sunday, and he went to scout another team, and somebody said, "John, what are you doing here?" He said, "Well, I've got to prepare for next week's game." He said, "But you're playing today."
Is that the guy who had the great line about there was no point in his going to any classes, and so he didn't?
Yeah, there you go. That was football in the early days. Actually, maybe it's still football today.
Yeah, I was going to say, some things never change. I enjoyed the column Red Smith wrote about a Yale-Harvard game back in 1947 because Red Smith seemed to be having such fun doing the work. He wrote of the fans, quote, "It was a hairy crowd wrapped thickly in the skins of dead animals." One almost wishes he hadn't turned his attention to the game.
They're so different than what we read today. Everybody's getting excited about everything today. I mean, it's life or death. And Red really was just enjoying himself. He was taking you to the game and painting a picture of the entire scene and who threw the interception or who missed the block or the tackle really didn't bother him that much.
For me, one of the most powerful pieces in the book is Jennifer Allen's account of how her father, George Allen, responded to being fired as coach of the Rams. Is it fair to say that that kind of profile really could only have been written by a family member?
Yeah, that one definitely. You know, as a reader, I really felt for her father. And believe me, I covered George Allen when I was working at the Washington Post. And I did not have the same sort of sympathy for him then. On my first day on the job, I went up and introduced myself to him. And he said, "Oh, where are you from?" And I said, "Well, I've been working in Baltimore the last 5 years." And he said, "Oh, a Colts fan, huh?" And turned on his heel and walked away. And I think he regarded me forevermore as a spy for the Colts.
My sympathy doesn't go to Allen. It goes to his family. This guy was so wrapped up in football that his idea of a family fun night was to watch football films all together.
You know, he also only ate ice cream because he didn't have to waste time chewing. Oh, he was pretty nutty. But when he was out of coaching finally and was taking everybody's calls, you know, I mean, he must have sat beside the phone all day. You really felt for the guy because he had to coach to live.
In this book, there are stories about former football stars who've done very well. Our own Charlie Pierce's profile of Archie Manning, for example. But also included is the story of the alcoholic and indigent former Tennessee great Bob Suffrage. Former pro Nate Jackson's account of drug abuse in the NFL is in there, and the story of Dave Duerson's dementia and eventual suicide. I wonder if those latter stories are in there because you didn't want readers to make the mistake of thinking of this as a volume that was simply a celebration of the game.
Football has certainly entered a dark period. I mean, it's still wildly successful and lucrative. But to not have those pieces in this book would not have been fair to readers or to the history I was trying to portray in some loose, scattershot way. This is what is happening. You know, the Duerson piece is just incredibly powerful. A guy who committed suicide, a former Bear, an all-pro safety. And he committed suicide by shooting himself in the heart so his brain would be intact for researchers to examine. Man. And yet, you read the Nate Jackson piece, which I loved. I mean, Nate Jackson is one of those rare treasures, an athlete who can really write. You know, and you see how much this guy loves the game. Mm-hmm. He both hates it and loves it. He hates what it's done to his body, and he hates the idea that he's really just a piece of meat to be tossed around on the great griddle of the NFL. And yet he loves it. He can't give it up. You know, I mean, and that all, I think, in a book that's honest about football has to be included.
John, when we do interviews with authors of books, we frequently put an excerpt from the book on our website. You will perhaps not be surprised that I've chosen as the excerpt this time around a piece from W.C. Hines.
Well, I think that's an excellent choice.
He starts the piece by saying, "I paid a dime to watch Red Grange carry the football."
I'm not sure what a dime gets you today. Nothing, I think.
You can't even make a phone call to ask about a ticket. John Schuling is the editor of Football, great writing about the national sport, and he joined me from KPCC in Pasadena, California. John, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Bill, thank you. I really appreciate it.
The head on Only a Game, what are Winter Olympians doing underwater? And a sport so nice, Shakespeare mentioned it thrice. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Rhythmic gymnastics?
You'll have to just keep listening.
I'll bet I'm wrong.
Yeah. The investigations continue into the death of Kevin Ward Jr., hit by the sprint car Tony Stewart was driving after a caution flag came out during a race in New York back on August 9th. Apparently, Kevin Ward's father has already come to some conclusions. He blames Tony Stewart. Your thoughts on this very sad occurrence?
This is a bizarre story, and I have a feeling that Tony Stewart's going to be living the life of a semi-criminal for the rest of his life. First of all, I don't know what a driver of Tony Stewart's caliber is doing driving in a sprint car track on a dirt track before a NASCAR race. I mean, I understand he's got his start there, and I understand he owns some of the teams there and so forth, but this was asking for trouble. I have no idea what he was doing. I find it enormously hard to believe that he didn't see Kevin Ward, because apparently every other driver on the track did. There are two investigations going on. I don't think Tony Stewart will ever shake this.
Major League Baseball has a new commissioner, Rob Manfred, who until Thursday was the league's chief operating officer, easily beat Boston Red Sox chairman Tom Werner in the election for that office. Good choice?
We'll see. We've got another collective bargaining agreement coming up, and one of the things you heard about Bud Selig was how he managed to keep the labor peace for 20 years. The coup against Manfred was led by people who really want a hard line in the next negotiations. They lost, but Rob Manfred knows that they're lurking out there somewhere in his primary constituency. So we'll see if Rob Manfred is a good commissioner when the next negotiations come up.
An FCC commissioner has labeled the NFL's so-called blackout rule outdated, and he has called for a vote on its removal. The NFL has responded by saying that such a move might result in fewer games being aired on free television. Wait, this isn't blackout. This is blackmail, right?
Nice little Sunday you have there, America. Be a shame if anything happened to it. Yeah, Roger Goodell.
I wouldn't even notice.
Roger, that's the great thing. Bill Littlefield would be the most popular guy in his neighborhood because he had no friends. He'd meet neighbors he never knew he had.
On Monday, the NCAA asked a California judge for clarification on two points in her ruling on the O'Bannon antitrust lawsuit. Is this just the first step in trying to block the ruling altogether?
No. I think there's legitimate reason for both sides to ask for clarifications on this one, because while the judge did reject every possible rationale for the NCAA's concept of amateurism, she did leave enough wiggle room and enough of the paternalism left in that decision to confuse people. Quite frankly, she did leave rather muddled what athletes were covered and what the alleged trust fund was going to be about and how much money.
Well, and then there's a business of protecting athletes from exploitation
corporations,
except the one corporation that's okay.
That's Judge Wilkin telling the judge in the next case, which is going to be called Kessler, the next one up in your program. That's that judge telling the future judge, hey, that one's in your court, fellas. Mm-hmm.
Somebody at Florida State University decided that it would be good fun to encourage fans on Twitter to submit questions to FSU quarterback Jameis Winston. I suppose that person anticipated such questions as, oh, how many touchdown passes will you throw this season? But I guess the promotion did not work out.
Bill, as you know, I work primarily on the intertubes now. And let me tell you something about the intertubes. It's the freaking wild kingdom out there. You don't leave this kind of wonderful sizzling steak out there and not expect people to show up with knives. My favorite question was, who gave you better protection last year, your offensive line or the Tallahassee Police Department?
Very nice. On Tuesday, the NBA announced that the sale of the Los Angeles Clippers to billionaire Steve Ballmer was complete, and on Wednesday, a court denied Donald Sterling's bid to block that sale. So, can we finally say this chapter is closed?
I hope so. Who knows? Donald Sterling can find something to sue somebody about anywhere, any day of the week. But it looks like this is pretty final. It looks like the NBA is breathing a huge sigh of relief.
Charlie, I did not know until this week that under Arizona law there is a violation called super extreme driving. Phoenix Suns forward P.J. Tucker learned this week that the term does not connote really good work behind the wheel.
Well, yeah, I read that myself. And, of course, it's super extreme driving while intoxicated.
Oh, what I must have been on the next line.
What I thought it meant was being drunk while you did stunts. But what it really means is being really, really drunk. And that's what P.J. Tucker was. He blew a 2-2-2 on the old breathometer, and now he'll be doing 3 days in jail.
The Buffalo Bills have not been short on distinctions. They lost the Super Bowl 4 times in a row. But according to the author of a book titled Ultimate Football Road Trip, the Bills can finally claim to be the best at something. What's that?
Super extreme driving. Yeah, no.
Super extreme fandom.
Super extreme fandom. Apparently, according to author Sean McDonald, the Bills fans are the drunkest fans in the NFL.
That is a distinction.
Now, there are two things I like to say about this. Number one, I believe it absolutely, having been to games in Buffalo. And number two, I hope this doesn't, like, engage the fans and the other 31 NFL cities to, like, up their games. Or more to the point, upchuck their games.
I really hope so, too, because so many of them have to drive home when the games are over.
And some of them are in Arizona.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland, and he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you, Bill.
A group of Olympian skiers and snowboarders have been spending time in Hawaii, and they're not on vacation. These athletes were training by learning to hold their breath and diving dozens of feet underwater. The Wall Street Journal's Matthew Futterman joins me to explain. Matthew, welcome back to Only a Game.
Good to be here.
Whose idea was it to train snowboarders and skiers by teaching them to spend more time underwater than they thought they could?
I think the main credit for the idea probably goes to Andy Wass, who's the head of high performance for Red Bull. I think most people know Red Bull as an energy drink maker, but Red Bull also is a big sponsor of sports. They're not just sponsoring these athletes, but they're training them too. And they're pretty much willing to try just about anything.
Tell me a little bit about what these athletes are hoping to accomplish with this training.
I think a lot of them are mainly hoping to accomplish the ability to relax. And a lot of relaxation begins with the breath and the ability to control your breath. Especially right before competition when you're nervous and when you're getting the jitters. And they're also trying to just get themselves to be comfortable in what is a very uncomfortable situation.
Were you surprised to learn that some of these top athletes, skiers, and snowboarders aren't calm and comfortable when they start down the hill?
Somewhat surprised, but the more time you spend with these people, the more you realize, you know, they put their pants on one leg at a time and they get nervous. And, you know, a lot of them are their kids.
Free diver Kirk Crack, who's working with these athletes, says that in just one day he can teach people to hold their breath for 4 minutes. How does he do that?
It starts with these very sort of slow warm-up breaths. You sort of enter a kind of meditative state. And really sort of using all of your capacity to bring in as much air as possible. And then there's a certain technique that you do with your throat that the analogy he used when he was describing it to me was sort of tying off the end of the balloon and trapping all that air in there. And then sort of also understanding how to deal with the inevitable feeling that your body has to want to breathe and to sort of rewire your brain and convince it to stay relaxed and that you'll be okay.
Deep diving has been criticized as dangerous, and it is dangerous. Are these athletes doing the same sorts of dives that have led to deaths in some cases?
I guess the answer to that question is both yes and no, and you're right to say it's dangerous. If there's any segment that is done on your show that should have a sort of don't try this all on your own warning before it, it would be this one. So if you are a free diver and you're going to set a world record and going all the way to the farther than anyone's ever gone before, chances are nobody's with you. So I think that's one real danger that gets eliminated when these athletes are practicing it. They always have a buddy, they know about safety, and you know they can be rescued.
Learning to stay calm underwater is one thing, but is that really transferable to staying calm at the top of a mountain?
I don't know that you can ever be completely sure, but when you talk to these athletes, it's understanding the idea that being fearful doesn't help you deal with the fear in any way. Mm. I think that's where the transference is. So much about these sports is confidence. The worst thing they can do is hesitate or hold back. That's the most dangerous thing they can do, because it's when you hesitate and hold back that you don't complete it and you get thrown off.
Do you see this method of training catching on, or are we looking at a fad here?
I see the idea of athletes doing everything they can to get some sort of psychological edge and get some sort of edge in terms of relaxation. I think that will catch on, and this is a method that works. I don't see any reason why more people won't try and do it. The issue here is, at this level, there's so little difference between in athletic ability.
Mm-hmm.
There's so little difference in training methods. You know, there's no secrets anymore. Information is everywhere. There are great coaches in almost every country. So what it really comes down to is, what can you do in that moment to make yourself most comfortable?
Matthew Futterman writes for the Wall Street Journal. You can link to his article, Why Olympic Athletes Are Learning to Hold Their Breath for More Than 5 Minutes, at onlyagame.org. Matthew, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Oh, thanks for having me.
The 2014 Commonwealth Games in Glasgow, Scotland, attracted more than 4,500 athletes from 71 nations and territories that once comprised the British Empire. The Games, which concluded on August 3rd, featured many fast events, including the men's 4x100-meter relay, in which Usain Bolt and his Jamaican teammates won gold. But fans also turned out for a sport that is decidedly slow. Then again, when a game has been played for centuries, it can afford to take its time. Only a game's Doug Tribou has our story.
There are three things I need to clear up right away about the sport of lawn bowls. First, lawn bowls does not involve pins. Second, lawn bowls is not bocce. Plenty of similarities, understandable mistake, but not the same game. And third, the word lawn is a misnomer, unless your idea of a lawn is a pristine rectangle of grass that could double as a massive putting green at a swanky golf course. The game wasn't invented in Scotland, but Scots came up with many of the rules still in place today. And bowlsclub.org lists 120 clubs in the city of Glasgow alone. So it's just the spot for one of the world's top bowls competitions. I'm standing outside Kelvin Grove Park, the site of the Lawn Bowls Center for the Commonwealth Games here in Glasgow, and the weather has turned decidedly more Glaswegian. The skies are gray, some rain is falling, and that's after 3 or 4 days of 80 degrees, sunshine, and humidity. And it seems appropriate for this sport that's so popular here in Scotland. The grass is lush and green, the courts are perfectly manicured, and despite the weather, hundreds of fans have turned out in ponchos and raincoats and carrying umbrellas to watch the games.
My name's Kate Smith, I live in Norfolk Island, and I'm the team manager.
26 squads have come to Glasgow, including Kate Smith and her teammates from Norfolk Island, which is in the South Pacific and has a population of about 2,000. The Commonwealth Games are held every 4 years, and Lawn Bowls has appeared on nearly every program since the first Games in 1930. There are men's and women's events in singles, pairs, triples, and fours. Between matches, Smith describes the basic goal of bowls.
There's a small white ball at one end of the green, which is 30-something meters away. And the object of the game is to get your bigger bowls closest to that little white ball at the end.
That small white ball, which can also be yellow, is known as the jack. Greg Davis is a bowler for Jersey, a semi-autonomous island in the English Channel.
Effectively, you've got to get more bowls closer to that jack by the end of the end than your opposition. Obviously, the more bowls you've got closer to the jack by the time all the bowls have been bowled, the more points you score.
Here in the shadow of Glasgow's famous Kelvin Grove Museum, the greens are divided into several lanes known as rinks. There are small ditches at each end. If the bowler sends the ball into the ditch without hitting the jack, it's taken out of play. After all the balls are rolled, competitors walk down the rink together and play the next set, or end, in the opposite direction. Although the lanes are flat, a roll is not a straight shot because the balls aren't perfect spheres, which makes them curve. Team Jersey bowler Chris Grimes.
They all come in various sizes. You choose it to suit your hand, and it's got a bias on it, so you have to choose which side you're going to bowl your bowl. If you do it the wrong way, you're going to get a wrong bias. It's going to shoot right over the other side of the green.
One quick point of clarification. In bowls, the balls are also called bowls. Some hardcore bowlers may be bowled over when they hear the terms used interchangeably, but I hope they won't ball me out because of it. Anyway, bowls is all about strategy, placing shots to knock an opponent's bowls out of position or bump a teammate's closer to the jack. Bowlers often play almost silently, but like any good sport, the athletes occasionally end up yelling at the ball.
Come home now. Come home now.
Fighting to come round.
That's a very good shot. Looks like a three.
BBC play-by-play, or roll-by-roll, is a modern addition to this ancient game. According to lore, English sailor and explorer Sir Francis Drake insisted on finishing a game before sailing off to battle the Spanish Armada in 1588, and Shakespeare referenced it in some of his plays, including King Richard II.
What sport shall we devise here in this garden to drive away the heavy thought of care?
Madam, we'll play at bowls.
But the game was hardly new when the bard penned his shout-outs. The world's oldest active bowls club is the Southampton Old Bowling Green in England. It opened in the year 1299. Today, this game for the ages is also a game for all ages. Young and old play side by side. Team Jersey's Chris Grimes started bowling when she was about 40. Today, she's 63 years old.
I took it up as a hobby and found out I was quite good at it and then got selected in competition. And so the bowls don't know your age.
Grimes' teammate Greg Davis is only 25. A computer business consultant by day, Davis discovered the game at the age of 12.
There's more young people getting involved now than I think for a long time, especially back home. So the future's bright from that perspective. But we do need to keep raising the profile of the game and making it more attractive for the younger bowlers so we get fresh blood in, and that can only be good for the sport.
The game's international governing body, World Bowls, reports 51 member nations, including the U.S. There's an annual Bowls World Cup, gotta be a soup joke in there somewhere, and the World Championships are held every 4 years. At the Commonwealth Games, South Africa topped the medal count, with Scotland, England, New Zealand, and Malaysia rounding out the top five. But Julie Brunt, who manages a large bowls center in Australia and traveled to Glasgow to root for some friends, says in bowls, camaraderie beats competition every time.
It's like one big happy family. We all get along very well. It's a very sociable game.
And that's the main reason why the game of bowls rolls on. For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribou.
During his trip to Scotland, Doug kept a reporter's notebook. See all of his photos and posts, including one about a purple Yankees hat and a LeBron James jersey, at onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribou. Our technical director is James Trout. Our assistant producer is Martin Kessler. Our intern is Mark Finn. We had help this week from Karen Miller-Medson and Lauren Gluck. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word is from a public domain reading of Hamlet.
There was a gaming there, or tokens, rouse.
Well, it's not about lawn bowling, but it's Shakespeare, so it can't be bad. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening, and whether or not you know a hawk from a handsaw, I'll see you next week.